led them to reject the very idea that there is a God. Well, we're going to be introduced to thoughts like that this morning and this afternoon as we examine Romans 1, verses 18 to 32. In verse 18, the apostle writes, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened." In those three verses, we find enough material to introduce the thought today that we are surrounded by evidence of God. The word "surrounded," of course, does not appear in this context, and yet one would conclude that it is a fair representation of what the context teaches. Because the Apostle Paul said, beginning there in verse 20, that the invisible things of God are seen since the creation. Now think about that, my friends. Since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen. There is reason, you see, to believe that God exists. And the profound statement of that reason here in this verse points us to the realm of nature. We sometimes wonder, why is the world the way it is? Why is life so possible? And why do we find conditions in this world, on this earth in particular, what they need to be in order to accommodate life, in order for us to live here? What is it that has happened? Well, God has made it all, and by means of what He has made, in other words, His product of creation, we're able to witness powerful and convincing evidences that God was behind it all. The thought that comes to us is the hand that made us is divine. Don't ever forget that. Don't ever forget the inseparable link between God and His creation. But beginning there in verse 18, we find the word "for" in most translations of the Bible. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." The word "for" in this sentence, if I understand it, introduces a reason for something already stated. The apostle has already stated the point in verses 16 and 17 that the God of this universe has undertaken to bring about salvation to the human race by means of the gospel of Jesus Christ, by means of the good news or the glad tidings in the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is God's power. It is God's dynamic, God's spiritual dynamic, or dynamite, to effect salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. And then he says in verse 17 that in the gospel, in the gospel message, God has revealed something. Notice that in verse 17. In it, the righteousness of God, or a righteousness of God, is revealed or made known. There's no reference here, I believe, to the attributes of God in this statement. When it says the righteousness of God, it's true that righteousness is one of the principal attributes of our God. He always seeks to do that which ought to be done, that which is right. But that's not a reference to his character here in this statement. This is a reference to the plan that God has provided as a means of attaining righteousness on man's part. God has revealed in the gospel, in it, God has made known a righteousness, that is, a way to become righteous for human beings. And thus, what he states here very concisely in verse 17, he elaborates on and explains in much detail in the rest of the letter to the Romans, that God has made known a way to be righteous. Now, why is that important? I'll tell you why. It's important because of what this word for introduces here in verse 18. God's wrath is revealed against sin. Why is it important that God has revealed not just his wrath against sin, but also a way to become righteous with God? Why is that? Why is it so important that we become righteous, that we become forgiven of our transgressions, pardoned of our offenses? Why? It's because God's wrath is revealed against sin. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress or hinder or hold down the truth in unrighteousness. So the unrighteousness of man coupled with his ungodliness are two of the main factors that work against the advancement of truth. We're going to see that made clear in this passage, 18 to 32, in our three lessons today. We're going to see that when human beings, first of all, close their eyes to the fact of a powerful Creator, they ignore the idea that God made the world. When they do that, they're likewise rejecting the very power that's going to hold them to the kind of living they ought to do. And they're going to drift into unbelief, accompanied by immoralities, all of which he discusses in the closing verses of this chapter. You see, there is a close connection between people's belief in God and people's practice of righteousness. That's because of that word ungodliness that is used here in verse 18. The word ungodliness has to do with impiety or irreverence. We sometimes think of ungodliness as practices or deeds that are just not right with God. Well, that's true, but that's not really the meaning of the word here. The word in this particular verse is that word which is commonly used in the epistles of the New Testament to describe that devotion or that piety or that reverence. In other words, the attitude of heart that holds us to God. That's godliness. That's the piety, the reverence, the devotion that we need. But when we reject that, then of course we move into the field of unrighteousness. And that's why he said there in verse 18 that God's wrath is revealed against sin. How did he explain that sin, though? How did he state it? All ungodliness, that is, that lack of devotion to God, that lack of reverence or piety expressed toward God, and then unrighteousness. Deeds of life which are not right, but they're not right because they don't reflect a devotion, a piety, a reverence toward our Maker. That's the point. So if there's not a point that we take home with us today besides this one, let us remember it. Let it be indelibly imprinted on our hearts, our minds, our souls, as it were, to remember that God's wrath is revealed against sin. Now that's why the studies today, as well as the studies the rest of the week through Thursday, are so important. They're important, my friends, because belief in God will keep us from this kind of living. Belief in God who made us will keep us from that lack of devotion, that lack of reverence, that lack of piety toward God, and from the unrighteous acts that usually follow where ungodliness is found. So I'm hoping you'll be here. I'm hoping you'll come back this afternoon. What is it, 5 o'clock? 6 o'clock, okay. I'm thinking of down home. come back at 6 o'clock. Because these lessons today are important in clarifying for us the connection between faith in God and the kind of life that God will not punish. On the other hand, he will reveal and has revealed, even in these verses, the wrath that he has toward ungodliness and unrighteousness. Now notice, just very briefly this morning, he first talks about the Gentiles as the ones with whom or against whom his wrath is going to be made known. They're the ones who, beginning there in verse 18, are under consideration, it appears to me. They're the ones who first turn their minds against God. They're the ones who first decided, this is something that we want to do. And so eventually they decided there is no God. We're not accountable to God. But my friends, there was a time when every human being on earth had a knowledge of God and a faith in God. Did you realize that? The Bible shows us that. In the time of Noah, for instance, when Noah and his family exited the ark, how many of those 8 souls that were saved by the water, how many of them knew about God and believed in God? All of them. Now, I'm not saying that they all held to the ways of God, because we know that in Genesis chapter 9, just about as soon as Noah came out of the ark, as it were, I'm not saying it was that minute, but sometime very soon, he became drunken and committed immoralities that he probably would not have committed had he not been drunk at the time. But I'm saying to you that there was a time when every human being on the face of this earth knew about God and believed in God. But then the time came eventually when mothers and daddies failed to tell their parents about God. They failed to transmit to their offspring a knowledge of God. They failed to give them reasons for believing in God. And as a result, there grew up generations which did not want to have God in their knowledge. We're going to see that as we develop these verses in the three lessons today. But that's how it happened. That's why it happened. It happened because, in a practical sense, this daddy and this mother and that father and that mother and then others fail to pass along that knowledge of God. Now I'm asking you this morning, what about you as a parent? Are you transmitting to your offspring the knowledge of God and the faith in God? Are you helping them understand reasons for believing in God? If you are, then you're doing what God wants you to do as a parent. If you're not, you need to change your ways. It's just that simple. Because how are these children going to grow up knowing about God, believing in God, unless they've had the kind of training that you're supposed to be giving them? And a part of that, by the way, is making sure that they're here this week for these classes. Have you already made that your aim for the week? Or are you perhaps even considering allowing something else, something far less important, to interfere with that? Don't do that. Do what you ought to do. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, the apostle said. Secondly, he dealt with God's wrath against Israel when we get into chapter 2 of the Roman letter. I'm not really developing that. I'm just simply stating it. Why? Because they too turned away from the knowledge of God that they once had. They too became unfaithful to God. They too became just as lacking in piety or devotion or reverence or godliness, to use the word here. They became just as bereft of it, just as lacking in it, as did the Gentiles. And they enjoyed the advantage of having the law and the prophets. They had access to reasons for faithfulness. But they didn't take advantage of them, did they? So you see, the point of the passage is, as we're going to see this morning, is that God Himself was justified. There's no doubt about that. God Himself was justified in aiming His wrath, or targeting His wrath, upon those who fell into ungodliness and unrighteousness. Why? Well, as this passage is pointing out, because God provided all the evidence that would ever be needed to keep them connected with God if they were honest in their hearts. He provides universal evidence. I don't care what the language spoken is. I don't care what the skin color is. I don't care how far removed the country might be from the United States of America. There is not a language or a voice where the voice of nature does not speak. That's what the psalmist tells us in the 19th Psalm. He says, there is no speech nor language where their voice, the voice of the things God has made, the created universe, there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. God has made it clear. He's made it clear on a worldwide basis, not just here in these United States. He's made it convincing. This evidence that He's provided. Now let's notice these three verses, or four verses, I guess it would be, 18 to 21 this morning, very briefly, as we continue our thoughts and then bring them to a close in a few minutes. I believe I have till 10:40, is that right? Okay? First of all, the idea that we've been emphasizing up to this point in different ways. The evidence supports the truth of God's existence and also supports the idea of Him as the source of revealed truth. Now, I'm not saying that revealed truth is in this context. It's really not, at least not in the statement there of verse 20. He's talking in verse 20 about God's eternal power, His deity or divinity, His Godhead or Godhood. These are on display. They're on constant display. 24 hours a day, 365 days out of the year, they're on display. That God has made the world. That's what the evidence shows, according to the Apostle Paul. But you know what? If it shows that kind of God, a God who has power and a God who has deity or divinity, that's far different from the gods that the Gentiles began to create when they strayed from the living and true God, isn't it? When they strayed, they started making their own gods with their own hands. That's what an idol is. It's the product of human creation. The very idea that brought about its inception is a human idea. The very attributes that are given or attributed to the idol and to the god represented are attributes that the human mind thought up or conceived of in the first place. But you know, it's far different with the living and true God. What He has made in this world, what He has made, not what made Him. He is nature's God. He's the God who brought the very work of nature into being. And He has displayed His power and His deity. But a God like that, as we're going to have to conclude or infer as we get to the end of the chapter, a God like that is going to reveal a message that will show people how to live, that will show people how to be godly, how to be reverent toward Him. He's going to show that because His wrath, remember, is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. So for a God like that who made the world, who spoke it into being from nothing, just by the word of His own power, that God also is going to show His concern for the lives lived by His creatures, especially His human creatures. But the evidence is there. It tells us, as verse 20 says, since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen. Being understood, you see, what God has made is understandable. That's not true just of His Word, not even talking about the Word here. It's talking about His creation. But it's understood by the things that are made. That is, the parts of the realm of nature that He's made. Even His eternal power and Godhead. Or to state it as He did in verse 19. What may be known of God or about God, you could also be translated. What may be known about God is manifest in them or among them. That is, among His human creatures. Why is it manifest among them? Because they're able to observe and draw fair conclusions from the universe that God has made. That's why. And so the things that may be known about God, namely His power and His divinity or deity, they're made known and they're manifest among His creation. For God has shown it unto them. You see, God is not unfair or unjust. He does not expect of human beings something they cannot do. Here's something they can do. They can fairly examine the evidence that he's provided and draw the conclusion that the hand that made them is divine. All right, let's move forward now. As we go down through these verses, 18 through 21, the evidence informs us of God's power and deity or divinity. I emphasize this aspect of it at this point. This is the means or the way in which the invisible God becomes visible. No, it's not that you can go out there and look at a tree and see a picture of God. That's not my point. But the idea is that if you look at the works of God in the realm of nature, you can see those attributes that we're talking about. His everlasting power, his divinity, his deity. That he's not just the product of human creation. That he's not been fashioned by man's mind or by man's hands. Those invisible attributes that are on display, they make him more visible to us, don't they? By informing us of him. By telling us something about him. And so, when you walk by the way, when you sit in your house, when you rise up, or when you lie down at night, take advantage of all of those situations in life. To talk to your young ones about the God who made the world. This is how faith is cultivated. And when we fail to do that, we're failing in our role as parents, aren't we? Why, it's no wonder that in Deuteronomy 6, in telling the people of Israel how they were to react under the various circumstances of life, in cultivating faith in their children, that he mentioned when you sit down, when you rise up, when you walk by the way, when you lie in your bed at night. Take advantage of all those situations. Look around you and see the opportunities, the occasions for talking to them about faith in Jehovah God. But then man's impiety or ungodliness and his unrighteousness are acts of rebellion against God. Why do people become irreverent toward God? I'll tell you why. Usually it's because they have decided that they want to do something that they know the Bible condemns. And they can't keep on believing the Bible and believing God and do what they want to do. They have to give up one of those two. Because man is endowed with a moral governor called a conscience. That rides herd, so to speak, on his actions, on his thoughts, or his lack of such. And so he has to give up, he has to turn loose of either his faith in God and what the Bible has to say, or else his desire to do what he wants to do. He can't maintain his own integrity by trying to hold on to both. And so usually people give up their faith in God because they're going to choose that route that they want to pursue in life. So human rejection of the evidence, that's what happens. They start looking for reasons not to believe in God once they've decided not to live the way he wants them to live. They start looking for reasons for rejecting the evidence. But if we have that evidence and a respect for it so ingrained in our beings, that won't happen nearly so easily. But to reject that evidence, my friends, is inexcusable. He says there at the end of verse 20, they are so that they are without excuse. Human beings who see what God has done in this wonderful world and turn their eyes against it or close their eyes to it, they're without excuse. They're acting dishonestly. That's the point. Now notice this. Oh, they knew God, as he says there in verse 21. As I said to you, there was a time when every human being knew God. And even after that time of Noah, there were many who knew God. But they followed the same basic route that others would follow. The route of irreverence. They did not glorify him as God. That's irreverence. That's an act or a failure to show reverence or praise and honor unto God. The failure to honor him as he is due. Closing our eyes to the evidence, we fail to worship him. We fail to praise him. And in the next part, nor were they thankful. Gratitude goes hand in hand with reverence. Those who reverence God understand that he is the source of all good gifts. The giver of every good and perfect gift. So what did these people do as they followed the path to moral degradation? First of all, they were not reverent toward God, failing to worship and honor him as they ought. Secondly, they were not thankful to God. Gratitude, my friends, or thanksgiving on our part, is the glue that holds us to God. When we keep on remembering that God is the giver of the gifts and keep on expressing that gratitude, then that glue is at work. It's the glue that keeps us bound to our Maker. But then they turn to vain thinking. He says, nor were thankful, but became futile or vain or empty in their thoughts. You know, when you turn away from God, the thoughts that ought to be there are not there anymore. And your mind becomes occupied with the unfruitful thoughts of wickedness. Futile or empty or vain thoughts. And there may be a connection here between this very idea of futile thoughts or vain thoughts and the vanities of idolatry. Because in the Old Testament, even the practice of idolatry was sometimes called vain things or vanities. And that may be a reference to it here. And finally, he said their foolish hearts were darkened. That's because the thoughts of God, the thoughts about God, his eternal power and godhood or deity are no longer there. That's because the idea of worshiping and praising and honoring God, those thoughts are no longer there. That's because the thoughts of righteous conduct are no longer there. When those thoughts depart our minds or depart our hearts, our foolish hearts become darkened, darkened by sin. That's the point. Well, this is the path, the downward spiral that he talks about. Oh, they professed to be wise, but they were really fools. And there are a lot of people today who profess to be wise, but really they're fools when it comes to closing their eyes to the evidence. The word fool there is the word moron. And there are a lot of people who act moronic when it comes to not taking the evidence that God has given. Well, our time is up, and so we're stopping for right now.